From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! School of the Assassins. Five anti-war activists will be sentenced tomorrow in Georgia for exposing the School of the Americas. Their judge, the same man who exonerated Lieutenant Calley for the My Lai massacre and jailed Martin Luther King. Also, the first part of our documentary, Puerto Rico, Reflections on the Oldest Colony. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Two former National Guardsmen convicted in the rapes and murders of three American nuns and a church lay worker in El Salvador have been paroled from prison. A five-man squad kidnapped, raped, and killed Roman Catholic nuns Ida Ford, Dorothy Kazell, and Maura Clark, and lay worker Jean Donovan on December 2, 1980. A third member could be released today. The two guardsmen were released yesterday under a new law intended to ease prison overcrowding. Each had served 17 years of a 30-year prison sentence. The New York-based Lawyers Committee for Human Rights reported earlier this year that one of the convicted guardsmen quoted Kalindris Alaman as telling the squad, "Don't be worried. This is an order that comes from higher levels, and nothing is going to happen to us." A 1993 UN Commission report determined that the director of the National Guard at the time of the slayings, Colonel Vidas Casanova, and Defense Minister Guillermo Garcia, had tried to hide the killings. It also concluded that Vidas Casanova knew that the guardsmen had killed the women on the orders of the superiors. Those two men now live in Florida. For years, the U.S. government has insisted there were no higher orders. But newly declassified State Department documents show that U.S. government officials, including former U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador Thomas Pickering, lied to the families about possible involvement of higher orders in the killings. The U.S. supported the Salvadoran government to the tune of $1 million a day throughout the 1980s. This news from Flint, Michigan, as General Motors shut down one truck plant and made plans to restart another. A federal judge yesterday ordered the automaker and the United Auto Workers to submit to binding arbitration over the legality of the union strikes. A U.S. district judge said in a court hearing that he will maintain jurisdiction over the case to enforce any decision by an independent arbitrator at hearings scheduled to start on Wednesday morning. If the arbitrator agrees the strikes are illegal, he could order striking workers from two Flint, Michigan parts plants back to work. But the strike yesterday hit GM's Canada truck plant, which ran out of stockpiled parts. GM also said it would reopen its Mexico truck plant later this week. An advisor to Palestinian President Yasser Arafat said today that U.S. brokered talks with Israel to break a peacemaking deadlock had ended in failure 3 days after they began. And this news from Jakarta, Indonesia's national police chief has ordered harsh measures against looters and said this could include shooting with live ammunition. This according to Indonesian newspapers. Last week, the country's defense minister and armed forces commander, General Wiranto, also warned that looting would not be tolerated and said the armed forces would protect citizens and their belongings. Meanwhile, the Indonesian military has detained four more soldiers of its special forces, Kopassus, in connection with kidnappings of political activists. This according to the military police chief. He said investigations so far show the activists had been held at the Kopassus Sinjantung headquarters in Jakarta. Several of the freed activists have spoken of torture during detention and said they were held in cells similar to those in military bases. We spoke with one of those detainees when he got out of jail. The military announced last week that seven Kopassus soldiers had been detained in connection with the kidnapping and illegal detention of the political activists. More than 20 activists opposed to the rule of the former dictator Suharto were kidnapped between late last year and March this year. It was revealed in March that the U.S. military trained the Kopassus forces in a wide range of tactics, including sniping. The Dutch government said today it had held talks with both the United States and Britain about the possibility of a trial in The Hague for two Libyans suspected of blowing up a Pan Am airliner over Scotland in 1988. For a decade, London and Washington have insisted the suspected men must stand trial in Scotland or the United States. But many feel the U.S. is being hypocritical as it has consistently opposed the establishment of an international criminal court. And this news from India, the Prime Minister has said that today India could surmount the sanctions imposed on it for conducting nuclear tests and said it would not change course under pressure. Finally, prosecutors summoned several uniformed Secret Service officers before a grand jury in the Lewinsky inquiry. Some information was sought to try to corroborate what other witnesses have said, although the Secret Service has said its employees saw nothing improper. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow, a Catholic nun, a Jesuit priest, and three other anti-war activists will be sentenced in Columbus, Georgia, for transforming a sign at the main gate of nearby Fort Benning. Benning is the host of the School of the Americas, a U.S. training center for the Latin American military. In their September 29, 1997 public protest, the five pride metal letters off Benning's entrance sign, replacing them with 10 words stenciled in red paint: Home of School of Americas, School of Shame, and SOA equals torture. In September of 1996, the Pentagon acknowledged that the SOA had long used training manuals endorsing torture, extortion, and assassination. The SOA is widely known to peace activists as the School of the Assassins. On March 4th, a jury found the five SOA activists guilty of destruction of government property with malicious intent, a felony. They will each be sentenced by federal judge J. Robert Elliott to up to 14 months in prison. This judge, Judge Elliott, is a notorious judge in Georgia. He is known as the man who exonerated Lieutenant Calley for the My Lai massacre and also jailed Martin Luther King, who appeared before him. We're now joined by some of the activists who will be sentenced tomorrow. Our first guest is Kathleen Rumpf, who is a prison advocate from Syracuse, New York. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Kathleen, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Thank you very much for being with us as you've headed down to Georgia now for the sentencing tomorrow. Can you tell us about why you protested the School of the Americas this past year?
I've been involved with the movement to close the School of America for quite a while now, and so this was a continuation of knowing what was happening in Central and South America and responding to it over many years now, and went to Fort Benning last year to put my body on the line, so to speak.
What got you first involved in the protest?
My first involvement was with Father Roy Bourgeois, who is now in prison, and listening to him speak. I also was very much affected with the death and the dying in Central America and hearing firsthand news of what was going on there. And then with the death of the Jesuits, the four church women and the two women who were killed with the Jesuits, that intensified my activity around the SOA issue, even though I was very, very involved with another issue in our local jail in Syracuse. It remained a priority as well.
Kathleen, you've had a long, interesting history of activism through your years. You're a well-known activist in Syracuse. 60 Minutes did a profile of you for exposing abuse in the Syracuse prisons. You've won the NAACP Annual Award in Syracuse for your human rights work. But you also, in the last year, have had some very strange dealings with the authorities. Can you talk about what happened to you when you went on a cruise ship with your mother?
Yes, I was on a cruise ship last December with my mother, and I was taken off by the FBI. There was a warrant for my arrest, which was a fugitive warrant, which was totally unnecessary, erroneous, and I was put in a prison in Miami and held there until I could get to court and advocate for my own release. When I was released, to the streets with no money, no ID, a prison outfit, no shoes that I could wear, and no way to get home. And it was really horrendous. And of course, having been an advocate for people in the jail, I was most horrified because I knew this is how they treated everybody. And there's no surprises there. And if the taxpayers knew how their monies were being used, even putting us protesters in prison is a misuse of tax dollars, because it'll cost $36,000 for 1 year of imprisonment for me or anybody else going in, and people come out more hurting, and it's a total waste of money.
I just wanted to clarify what happened to you when you were there. They took you in, they took you off this cruise ship. They said there was a warrant or something for your arrest, when in fact there wasn't.
There was a warrant in the computer because the court failed to just call me and tell me to come to court. Instead, they just issued a warrant. I was waiting for the courts to contact me. I was released on my personal reconnaissance after doing a witness in Georgia at the School of the Americas, waiting to hear from the court, and I happened to be in Florida on a cruise ship with my mother. My name went into a computer, and not knowing there was a warrant for my arrest, they came on and handcuffed me and led me off the ship and put me in a high-security unit in a prison in Miami.
We're talking to Kathleen Rumpf, who is one of the protesters who will be sentenced tomorrow in a Georgia court along with four others. At this point, after you've gone through what you've gone through, which I think can only be described as persecution by the authorities, exactly how long do you plan to, what is the possible sentence you can get?
I believe my guidelines will be 8 to 14 months in prison, and I go into the courtroom tomorrow. I want to make a statement myself. Not only are people suffering and being killed and tortured in unspeakable atrocities, but people here suffer because of our misplaced priorities, meaning the homeless and the hungry and single mothers. And so I go into court making a statement, having worked and lived with the homeless and with people in jail, to make a statement about the abuse here, the low-intensity conflict going on here at home.
But how many years do you face?
Oh, 8 to 14 months, Amy, I'm sorry.
And what do you expect to get?
I'm thinking a year. It's a speculation. Anywhere between 12 and 14 months is what I expect.
Now, I understand Ed Kinane is also standing with you at the payphone you're speaking with us from. Ed Kinane, a peace activist also from the New York area. Earlier this year, as we have been describing, he and 21 other activists were sentenced by Judge Elliott, the same judge who will be presiding tomorrow, to a $3,000 fine and a maximum penalty of 6 months for unlawful entry onto the Fort Benning base, to the School of the Americas, which is a misdemeanor. Their crime, peacefully seeking to petition Fort Benning to close the School of the Americas. Ed, why are you willing to take this time out of your life to go to prison?
Oh, it's a matter of conscience. I think that we North Americans have such complicity in the existence of the School of the Americas that we need to do something to close it down. The stakes are so high. And our going to prison is doesn't begin to match the kinds of sacrifices that people in Latin America make on a daily basis.
Ed, what do you do normally?
Well, since I've had a string of jobs over the years so that I could finance my my activism, I've been involved in Latin America solidarity work and other issues also over the years.
This judge, tell us about him, Judge Elliott, who you face tomorrow.
Well, he's the oldest federal judge in the country. He was appointed by Jack Kennedy back in the 60s, and Kennedy knew at the time that this man was a dyed-in-the-wool segregationist. I mean, he was a notorious segregationist at the time. He issued injunctions against against Martin Luther King's demonstrations. He also, at the time during the Vietnam era, when Lieutenant Cayley of My Lai fame was in the courts here in Georgia, he released Lieutenant Cayley, feeling that I think his rationale had been something like that. He felt that Lieutenant Cayley had been tried in the press and so was a victim. I've been before the judge several times now. He's obviously an elderly man, very set in his ways, and not very interested in us being able to explain why we did what we did.
Now, you weren't alone in November. For people who say activism is dead in this country, there were how many people who protested? Something like 2,000 at
the Swirling Marcus? Well, there were 2,000 people at the gate of Fort Benning on November 16th. And of those 2,000, 601 took part in the liturgical procession onto the base. We went two by two, the somber, silent procession. And those 601 were all arrested. We were carrying petitions with hundreds of thousands of signatures. All our petitions were confiscated. We were all detained for processing that day and then released. And of those 601, those that had who had been arrested before at Fort Benning were then, had to appear in court. And most of those are now serving 6 months in prison.
And among those is Father Roy Bourgeois, who has been leading these protests and lives outside the base for a number of years now.
Yes, he lives about 20 yards from the base gate.
Ed Kinane, I was wondering if you can put Kathleen Rumpf on, because I understand she'll be wearing a very interesting T-shirt
to the
sentencing tomorrow. Again, we're talking to Ed Kinane and Kathleen Rumpf. They're two protesters who will be sentenced tomorrow in Georgia for their protest at the Fort Benning School of the Americas. And when we come back from the break, we'll speak with one more activist who actually just got out of prison. But Kathleen Rumpf, I don't usually ask people what they're wearing, but what will you be wearing to your sentencing tomorrow?
I'll be wearing the jail outfit I was released to the streets with in Miami, with a T-shirt over it. And on the back of the T-shirt is the photograph of the My Lai massacre and the words, "Judge releases Lieutenant Cayley." And on the front is a picture of me smiling that says, "Pardon me, too."
I'm sure that'll endear you to the judge.
Yes.
In terms of activism today, do you see activism waning? People talk about apathy, that the economy is good for many in this country, and so that people are just, not really willing to get involved in a political process that's corrupted by money, where, people who care about the world can't get involved because they don't have the money to run.
I think that, there is strong tradition starting from the very beginning of who we are as a country, and people do carry on that tradition. There is an ebb and flow, and times are harder. People struggle. Students can't leave college and go off like they did in the 60s because there's too much at stake in their lives, and the loans they've taken out were more connected into systems and little boxes, which makes it very difficult for us to break out and take these stands and then risk going to prison. I had to pack up my apartment, and I had so many things to do. I mean, it's very, very difficult. But then again, we're not trying to justify murder. We're just trying to justify saving lives, and it's worth it. It's somebody's got to stand, and the movement's growing. And I ask, when the next person comes on, Carol, she'll be able to tell your audience maybe something that they can do to help close the school.
Well, Kathleen Rumpf, I want to thank you for joining us. Ed Kinane as well, both to be sentenced tomorrow in Georgia court for their protest at the Fort Benning base. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Carol Richardson, and then we're going to go to a documentary on this week that is the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico. We'll also ask Carol Richardson, who is a United Methodist minister. We're going to ask her who was trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning. The number of SOA Watch, that School of the Americas Watch, is 706-682-5369. That's 706-682-5369. 9, because the activism there does continue. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. On the line with us now from Georgia is Carolyn Richardson, who is a minister with the United Methodist Church. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Carolyn.
Thank you very much.
You just got out of jail. You won't be sentenced tomorrow. How long were you serving?
I served 6 months in Alderson Federal Prison in Alderson, West Virginia, and this was as a result of the action November 16th of last year. And actually, there are still currently 19 people who are continuing to serve their 6 month terms. I just happen to be the first one in and the first one out.
Why these different sentences? Why did you get sentenced right away, and why have they waited all this time?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were separate actions and separate charges. As Kathleen mentioned, there were 601 people arrested. There were 25 people who were then considered repeat offenders, and three of us went before a U.S. magistrate kind of to test the waters right after the action to see what was in store for everyone, and we found out real quickly that they were going to slap us with a maximum sentence and a $3,000 fine. And then the other folks went before Judge Elliott, and they were sentenced and then entered prison in March.
Carolyn Richardson, who has been trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia?
Well, you know, the School of the Americas has trained roughly 60,000 Latin American soldiers, and consistently, I mean, every time a human rights report comes out that names human rights abusers, you can absolutely count on it that the School of the Americas will, you know, will be named there. For example, the recent report that came from Guatemala, the Remy report, which actually resulted in the death of Bishop Perardi in Guatemala, that report, you know, named over and over again, you know, that the perpetrators or the architects of the genocide campaign in Guatemala were School of the Americas graduates. And this is consistent. I mean, a human rights report just recently came out of Colombia, and over half of the graduates that were named in that report were School of the, half of the abusers that were named in that report were School of the Americas graduates. And I, one of my greatest fears right now is that we're going to see the same pattern emerge in Mexico. Up until very recently, the School of the Americas received almost no students from Mexico. Mexico considered it a matter of national pride not, you know, not to send students, you know, to for training. But very shortly after the Zapatista uprising, Mexico began pumping the students in the School of the Americas. And now Mexico is the largest single country client of the School of the Americas. And, you know, if they follow the pattern that we've seen repeated over and over again in Central America, we'll see that the School of the Americas graduates will end up being the line of folks that lead the repression and lead the abuse that we see and hear on reports coming out of Mexico.
What do you think people can do? Of course, people can go down and protest at the School of the Americas, but what else can people do to support the kind of work that you all have done and that you all are going to prison for and have gone to jail for?
Well, there's some very, very specific things right now. In fact, I just came off of Capitol Hill. I literally walked out of prison and walked onto Capitol Hill because we have a vote that is coming up in the House. The debate on it will begin next week, and we could have a vote probably by the end of next week on it. And it will be an amendment that's offered by Representative Kennedy from Massachusetts and Representative Torres from California. and it will be an amendment that will cut about a quarter of the operating budget for the School of the Americas. So people need right now to call their representative and to let the representative know that they want them to support the amendment to cut funds for the School of the Americas. Even if their representative has voted for this in the past, they need to call them anyway because it's going to be very close. We think we have a good chance to win, but we cannot squander any possibility of a vote. We also have a Senate vote that is coming up, and we're expecting that, and that, too, could be coming up within the next 2 weeks. So people also need to be calling their senators.
Well, Carolyn Richardson, it sounds like you got out of jail just in time to get involved with the momentum around those bills. And I want to thank you very much for joining us as well from Georgia, joining with the other protesters who will be sentenced tomorrow in a Georgia court. Thank you for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with our program today. On July 25, 1898, U.S. troops invaded Puerto Rico. This weekend, people will gather from all over the country, from San Francisco to Minneapolis, from Boston to Orlando, in Washington, D.C., for the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion, and mobilize around the issue of the island's status. Just 4 months ago, the controversial Young Bill was passed by the House of Representatives, which once again has drawn attention to the debate over statehood, independence, or commonwealth for Puerto Rico. The bill, sponsored by Alaska Republican Don Young, calls for a plebiscite to be held in Puerto Rico later this year to determine the island's future status. The Jornada Nacional Puerto Rico 98 takes place this Saturday in Washington. The aim of the demonstration, to denounce the centennial of the U.S. invasion and colonization of Puerto Rico, to reaffirm the right of Puerto Rico to a process of self-determination, and to demand the release of Puerto Rican political prisoners. Throughout these discussions about Puerto Rico's political status, however, very little has been said about the presence of the U.S. armed forces on the island and its impact on the land and its people. Today, we bring you the first part of a documentary, Puerto Rico, Reflections on the Oldest Colony. The documentary also includes personal reflections of the producer, Mario Murillo. He's the public affairs director at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York and host of the national radio program, Our Americas. He'll share his thoughts as well on what Puerto Rico means and what July 25th signifies to Puerto Ricans around the country.
We have not come to make war upon the people of a country that for centuries has been oppressed, but on the contrary, to bring you protection, to promote your prosperity, and to bestow upon you the immunities and blessings of the liberal institutions of our government. General Nelson Miles, July 25, 1898, Guanica, Puerto Rico.
Under the Constitution of the United States, no power is given to the federal government to acquire territory to be governed permanently as colonies.
From the Congressional Record, 55th Congress, First Session, February 6, 1899.
A people constituted on a basis so free and democratic cannot bring forth tyrants. That is the reason why we trust in the justice that will be given soon to us. The offspring of these who signed the Declaration of Independence can't do less than give liberty to our people. From La Democracia, July 4, 1899.
We understand that the effect of the Treaty of Paris was to put the United States into possession of Puerto Rico. We do not understand it was intended or expected to make them a state, or to do that which entitled them to be called even a territory. We understand that we have a right to legislate with respect to them as we may see fit. Senator Joseph Foraker, U.S. Senate, March 2, 1900.
In 1998 is the 100th year of American intervention in Puerto Rico.
It symbolizes the celebration of our people of 100 years in union with the United States.
Centennials provide ample room for thought about the past and about the future.
Son 100 años de presencia militar estadounidense que se cumplen ahora el 25 de julio de 1998.
A date that 100 years ago brought in the Stars and Stripes in Puerto Rico with an accompanying promise of democracy and equal rights for our people.
When 100 years have passed by and the United States faces the fact that it is the last colonial power in the world, certain people in the United States start asking themselves questions about what should happen regarding Puerto Rico.
And we are hoping that the people of Puerto Rico will unite to demand that colonialism and the dominance of the United States over Puerto Rico be ended.
July 25th, 1898. The date United States troops commanded by General Nelson Miles landed on the shores of Guanica in southern Puerto Rico. As the Spanish government prepared its surrender in the final stages of what U.S. history books now call the Spanish-American War, the United States took control of an island which it had always considered a central component of its growing empire. What essentially could have been handled on the diplomatic front was carried out by the Marines. Thus began a century of U.S. domination of Puerto Rico, politically, economically, culturally, and militarily. Today, 100 years later, we're forced to look at Puerto Rico once again. For some, Puerto Rico is a lovely tropical paradise, a charming vacation spot in the Caribbean where one can get off on jet skis and slot machines. For others, Borinquen is home, even for the millions of Puerto Ricans who weren't born on the island and whose connection to it stems from their parents' and grandparents' memories. For me, Puerto Rico serves as a constant reminder of the contradictions of the principles from which this country, the United States, was supposedly founded upon: liberty, justice, and self-determination of a people. As I woke up to the sounds of the gallos in the early morning hours during a recent visit to the island, I began to taste Puerto Rico once again. I started to think about the never-ending debate over the island's status. What would be more viable, statehood, independence, or an advanced form of commonwealth, whatever that's supposed to mean? I thought of the U.S. Congress considering legislation that calls for a Puerto Rican plebiscite to decide the island's status once and for all. And finally, I started to think about the military, the U.S. Navy, the armed forces. In Puerto Rico, the U.S. presence began with a military invasion in 1898. Today, the domination of the island continues through the military. Never mind that according to United Nations guidelines on decolonization, all military activities by an occupying force should cease completely before any true process of self-determination can take place. This has never been spelled out in the different status debates carried out in the U.S. Congress. It seems to me that the failure to address the role of the U.S. military makes the entire plebiscite process now being considered in the Congress inadequate, a sentiment which is shared by many people, especially in Vieques, a small island about 6 miles off the eastern coast of mainland Puerto Rico.
Okay, muy buenas noches a todos y bienvenidos aquí a esta importantísima actividad. Nosotros tenemos esta noche una actividad histórica.
It's a Tuesday night at the Fort Count Mirasol Museum in Vieques, named after the 1845 colonial governor of Puerto Rico. In the high-ceilinged circular parlor of this 19th century structure, about 100 local residents, fishermen, students, clergy members, and community activists have come together for a town meeting. They're here to speak out against the constant military maneuvers being conducted by the U.S. Navy on their island.
Quiero decirle que yo tengo unos añitos encima, pero que recuerdo la expropiación en carne viva. Nosotros hemos sufrido demasiado y estamos sufriendo todavía.
72-year-old Lucia Carambot says she may be old, but she remembers as if it were yesterday the days when the Navy arrived in 1940. The commanders told residents in her village that they had to leave within 15 days or be forcibly removed. She says her father refused to leave and resisted for several years before finally having to give in to the Navy.
For us, it's been about 60 years of being surrounded. I say surrounded because to the east and to the west, there are military bases. We carry with us an agony and a suffering, because where are we supposed to go? We have nowhere to go. We're trapped.
Lucia Carambot feels trapped because the Navy has controlled more than two-thirds of Vieques since 1940. It was in 1940 that the Navy expropriated 26 of the island's 33,000 acres. Vieques is now divided into three areas. On the west end of the island, the Navy maintains a vast munition storage facility, where hundreds of tons of explosives are stored in over 100 magazines built on hillsides. On the east end, it conducts regular bombing tests from ships, jets, helicopters, tanks, bazookas, and mortars, and experiments with new weapon systems. On a narrow sliver in the middle of the island lives the civilian population, surrounded by what has become the main component of the Navy's Atlantic Fleet.
This is the premier range on the Atlantic Fleet where they can bring all their warfare areas together.
Lieutenant Mike Amos is the Atlantic Fleet's inner range officer and coordinates the bombing tests and training maneuvers in Vieques.
This is the only place that they can do that. They can bring an amphibious landing, giving naval surface fire support while they're doing the landing, do air-to-ground, and what we call supporting arms, artillery, from out in the eastern area, firing into the very eastern tip or the live impact area. They can put that all together. This is the only place that they can do that.
The question that most Vieques ask is, why not conduct these military operations somewhere else?
Vieques is one of the most important archaeological places in the Caribbean, particularly over the last 15 to 20 years.
At the Fort Count Mirasol Museum, Roberto Rabin guides a group of international delegates on a tour of the 19th century fort, describing some of the archaeological riches of the area.
A new cultural complex was discovered here, now known as Huecoide, in honor of La Hueca, which is this small region just west of Esperance on the south coast of Vieques. A group of indigenous people.
Originally from Boston, Rabin has been living in Vieques now for over 25 years. And currently runs the Fort Count Mirasol Museum. He's a member of the Committee for the Rescue and Development of Vieques, a grassroots organization that has been fighting against the U.S. Navy's presence on the island since 1993. Rabin is an outspoken opponent of what he calls the Navy's destructive history on Vieques.
The Navy presence on Vieques prohibits the completion of Vieques archaeology, does not allow the people of Vieques, archaeologists from Puerto Rico or from anywhere else, to know about the entrance point or the leaving point, which would be the eastern and western ends of Vieques, because they're both controlled by the Navy. They also said, and allowed me to quote them by saying, that the Navy bombing and other Navy activities has significantly destroyed important archaeological evidence, and that the control that the Navy has over three quarters of Vieques islands means that they not only control three quarters of the land and agriculturally important land, or possibly tourist development areas, or the best aquifers, the highest mountains, the most important lagoon areas, etc., but they also control three quarters of Vieques' cultural patrimony, three quarters of the archaeological and historical.
Besides having an impact on the important archaeological sites in Vieques, opposition to the Navy is based on serious concerns involving the island's environment and the health of its residents. Environmental scientist Dr. Neftali Garcia is the president of Scientific and Technical Services, an environmental research group based in San Juan.
We found that the explosions have damaged various lagoons in the eastern portion of the island. Craters are abundant in that portion of the island. Actually, a student of ours did a thesis last year, and she examined aerial photos since the 60s and found that the number of craters has increased per unit area, and the total area affected by explosions has increased in the last 3 decades. Also, we found evidence that the Navy had closed the connection of lagoons to the sea. Therefore, during dry spells, there was an increase in salinity and decrease in dissolved oxygen in the lagoons, and many fish were dying in them.
Many of the ecological problems in Vieques stem from the ongoing bombing tests conducted almost year-round, every year, since 1940.
Bombardment has increased erosion that has affected other lagoons in the eastern portion of the island. There are remnants of metals and, of course, explosives in those lagoons and sediments that definitely must have affected aquatic life in such areas. Also, explosions take place in the sea and affect the reefs, the Thalassia seagrasses, that are extremely important for the protection of juvenile stages of fish and other organisms, and also for the ecological well-being of different marine organisms that are important for fish and therefore for fishing.
You're listening to Puerto Rico Reflections on the Oldest Colony. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. We continue with the documentary produced by Mario Murillo when we come back.
Cero voy para Marcané, llego a Puerto, voy para Mayarí. El cariño que...
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the documentary Puerto Rico, Reflections on the Oldest Colony, produced by Mario Murillo.
The military presence has been devastating for our fishermen. It's been the worst nightmare that you can have.
Carlos Ventura is a member of the Southern Vieques Fishing Association and a spokesperson for the Committee for the Rights of Fishermen in Vieques.
Since the Navy arrived, and up to this day, we've had problems with them regarding restrictions on where we can fish. And on top of that, we've had to cope with the destruction of the fish life. Vieques is a place that has abundant fish. It's a place where the Caribbean Sea joins with the Atlantic Ocean, creating a strong current that in turn gives life to the plankton, which is the basis of the food cycle. Vieques used to be the largest producer of fish and other seafood for all of Puerto Rico. But since then, things have gotten to a point where the fishermen in Vieques is almost nearing extinction. And this is directly related to the bombing practice that takes place regularly on the eastern end of the island.
In Vieques, we have several conservation zones. This one we're showing here is the Monte Pirata.
At the Roosevelt Roads Naval Station in La Ceiba, on the eastern end of mainland Puerto Rico, the Navy's Winston Martinez briefs a small group of visitors about the environmental conservation programs the Navy has established for Vieques.
Another conservation zone we have in Vieques is Cayo Conejo. The importance of this little island is that it is a nesting habitat of the brown pelican, which is another endangered species.
Martinez is the coordinator of the Navy's Cultural and Natural Resources Protection Program at the Roosevelt Roads Base and its satellite facilities in Vieques. He says the Navy is actually helping the fishing industry in Vieques.
The information I have of the environmental impact statement that was made in, back in 1980 and another one in 1986 is that there is no impact to the fish of the area. In fact, when there are maneuvers, fishing is restricted, okay, because of the safety of the area. In that way, actually, the maneuvers are helping to preserve the fish population of the area.
In what way? How is that?
Because it's not being overfished. Because the area is closed for fishing for, let's say, 2 or 3 weeks at a time.
But the concerns Villaquenses have about the Navy go beyond the fishing docks in the southern part of the island. To a certain extent, what has caused most alarm among the residents of the civilian sector of Vieques is how these war games are affecting the health of the population. Vieques native Dr. Rafael Rivera Castaño is a retired epidemiologist who taught for years at the University of Puerto Rico School of Public Health in San Juan.
And when I came returned to Vieques, I had the feeling, looking at it, there are a lot of cases of cancer, especially in young people, leukemia, breast cancer in young women, cancer in young people, teenagers. This was strange. I mean, Vieques is small population, 8,000 population, small town. How many, so much cancer? This is something real.
Dr. Rivera and other doctors in Vieques pressured the health department to conduct a study to see why the cancer rate in Vieques appeared to be so high. The study showed that while the cancer rate in Vieques in the 1960s and 70s was lower than it was in the rest of Puerto Rico, by the late 1980s, it was 26.9% higher. Rivera says another study conducted by his colleagues at the School of Public Health showed even more alarming figures.
They did a projection of what's happening in the 90s. And the projection they did, statistically well done projection, states that by 1994, the cancer in Vieques was 52% higher than the rest of the island of Puerto Rico. This is the problem we have in Vieques. What is happening in Vieques that is causing this cancer incident? Vieques doesn't have any pharmaceutical industries, no industries that will contaminate the environment. They only have one industry, General Electric, that the only they made is switches for electric switches that don't contaminate. There's nothing else in Vieques. The only thing that we can think of that contaminates the environment that would cause this cancer incident is the Navy.
Once again, Dr. Neftali Garcia of Scientific and Technical Services.
The explosions take place in the eastern portion of the island, and trade winds have an east-west component. Therefore, air pollution that includes particulate matter, that in turn includes remnants of explosives, metals, and so on, do travel to the west, to the populated areas. So the main source of environmental damage and pollution in Vieques is the Navy. Also, remnants of explosives were found a few years ago in supposed potable water in Vieques. Therefore, if these remnants were found in the water, it's because they were carried by the wind from the east to the west. And if it was found in the water, it must be in the soils, and it must had been in the air. And people in Vieques that receive this particulate matter from the east, therefore, are being affected by heavy metals and by remnants of explosives.
But the Navy denies any serious damage has been caused to the ecosystem of Vieques and continues to downplay the health concerns being voiced by people like Neftali Garcia and Dr. Rivera Castaño.
We are constantly striving to open those lines of communication between the naval station and the locals.
Navy spokesperson Bob Nelson is public affairs officer at the Roosevelt Roads Naval Station, from where the bombing tests in Vieques are coordinated.
As you can imagine, anytime you have a military installation, there's going to be some kind of hostile activity by some of the community who are not totally in favor of the military. Oh, yeah, right. But I would say in general, we do have a good understanding with the local community, and we are constantly trying to bring our programs, our educational programs, and the Navy's mission on this island, and we want to give back to the island of Puerto Rico what they have given to us.
Or as many Puerto Ricans see it, taken from them. The opposition to the Navy is by no means isolated or limited to some troublemakers. This was demonstrated in 1996, when the Navy announced plans to install a new high-tech radar system on 8,000 acres of land, which were supposed to be turned over to the civilian sector of Vieques. It was part of a much larger project known as the Relocatable Over the Horizon Radar, ROTHR, intended to be used by the Navy in U.S. drug interdiction efforts in Latin America. For the people of Vieques, the ROTHR became yet another issue of concern. Dr. Tania Garcia is a professor at the University of Puerto Rico in Calle and is an associate of scientific and technical services.
In terms of the electromagnetic radiation, it could be more harmful for the Viequenses, for people who live close to the Playa Grande area.
The ROTHR system would involve a transmitter to be placed in Vieques and a receiver to be located somewhere on the mainland. Initially, they proposed putting it in the Lajas Valley in southwestern Puerto Rico, but those plans were greeted by numerous protests by the Lajas community. They were supported by Vieques residents and other opponents of the U.S. military, culminating in a protest march on mainland Puerto Rico, where over 50,000 people participated. The Navy changed its plans and is now looking to put the receiver components in the town of Juana Díaz. Once again, Tania Garcia.
Specifically in Lajas, they were concerned about the agricultural impact that a radar could have, that the installation of the radar could have on the Lajas Valley. In Vieques and Juana Díaz, we are concerned about the territorial extension that it's going to be used for this military installation. The Viequenses are going to be more affected, definitely, because, as I said, the radiation emitted by the transmitter is more powerful than the receptor that it's proposed now for Juana Díaz. In the past, they were proposed in Lajas as a first site for the receptor, but now they changed as a response of the opposition. They are considering as a first site for the receptor Juana Díaz. We are concerned about the health impact that this electromagnetic radiation could have on the Viequenses, specifically on 10 to 15 families that live like 500 meters from where the radar it's going to be installed.
While the people of Lajas successfully kept the Navy from installing the radar, in Juana Díaz and Vieques, they have not been as lucky. In June, the Navy began clearing the area in Vieques where the transmitter components of the ROTHR system are to be placed. Again, it was carried out without discussing it with the local population. Despite the protests, Puerto Rico Governor Pedro Rosselló has defended the radar project.
The issue of the radar, and specifically, we feel that that's an instrument that is needed in the effort and in the war against drugs. We feel that that's a top priority in Puerto Rico. So I think we have always seen this as an instrument that would increase our capabilities in terms of combating illegal drug trafficking into Puerto Rico. And that's certainly the idea. I think anybody that says that this is a military instrument, I think is probably a little confused. As a matter of fact, this is something that's being stimulated and proposed from the White House through its program against drugs.
Opposition to the Navy in Vieques cuts across political lines. One of the most visible examples is the three-term mayor of Vieques, Manuela Santiago. Mayor Santiago is a member of Rosselló's new progressive party, PNP, which advocates that Puerto Rico become the 51st state. In balancing the demands of her constituents with the positions of her party, she is careful not to speak too harshly of the Navy.
Nosotros sabemos que la Marina no se va a ir de Vieques.
We know that the Navy is not going to leave Vieques. It is painful, but they are not going to leave. They've already established that. They even have a memorandum of understanding in which they recognize that although they are potentially damaging Vieques, they will not leave. Because if they were to leave Vieques, the largest U.S. military base in the Western Hemisphere would become useless.
Este lugar que no entiendo, este espacio reducido, este mundo adolorido, viendo.
The flood came to Puerto Rico, unexpected, unwelcome, like American tourists, and it left like American tourists, taking all and leaving nothing. The flood came to Puerto Rico, and with it came geologists. They are trying to find new names for the many lakes and rivers that now exist, where towns once were, where homes once stood, where people once lived, where children once played in the warmth of afternoon suns, where the beautiful culture that is mine once sang its loveliness over hills and mountains. The flood came to Puerto Rico, and American Airlines is taking pictures for their advertisements of their new lagoons, where the Kennedy family will vacation this summer, next summer, all year round. The flood came to Puerto Rico, killing my people, drowning them in a new form of oppression, leaving them jobless, homeless, to the mercy of American kindness, with begging hands in the air, with tears in their eyes, with crying and dying babies in their arms, leaving them with less than what they were known to have, lost, separated from their mutual loves. The flood came to Puerto Rico, and with it came the Red Cross, after the flood, to search for Rockefeller's summer home. Que se han equivocado.
As I look back at my recent visit to Roosevelt Roads, I think about the handsomely kept lawns and the small houses on the base, the shopping center, the bowling lanes, Cineplex, all that make Rosie Roads a typical Middle America town. The place is completely off limits to the local residents, the local community. Then I think about all these military men decked out in uniform, walking through the halls of the air-conditioned offices, smiling at each other, patting each other on the back, not even questioning why they're there, or worse yet, with the assumption that they have every right in the world to be there. The same assumption that allows the U.S. Stars and Stripes to hang alongside, but higher than the Puerto Rican flag everywhere you go on the island. It's a Yankee arrogance that tries to come off as benevolence, reminding me of the words once again of General Nelson Miles when he landed his troops in Guanica on July 25, 1898.
We have not come to make war upon the people of a country that for centuries has been oppressed, but on the contrary, to bring you protection, to promote your prosperity, and to bestow upon you the immunities and blessings of the liberal institutions of our government.
Try telling that to the people of Yeques. When we come back, we'll hear why the military has no real intentions of leaving Puerto Rico, and how the debate over the island's status is leaving out the question of what to do with the U.S. bases in Puerto Rico. You're listening to Puerto Rico, Reflections on the Oldest Colony. I'm Mario Murillo. Stay with us.
Wonderful documentary, Mario, and we'll be bringing you the second part of Puerto Rico Reflections on the Oldest Colony tomorrow on Democracy Now! And if you'd like a copy of today's program or of Puerto Rico Reflections on the Oldest Colony, the full hour documentary, you can order a cassette copy from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also reach Mario by email at mmcompa@igc.org. That's mmcompa@igc.org. You can reach us at Democracy Now! At democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Ku and Jeremy Scahill. Michael G. Haskins is our engineer, Michelle Garcia, our webmaster. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. Again, tomorrow on Democracy Now!, we will play the second half of Mario's documentary, Puerto Rico, Reflections on the Oldest Colony. And on Friday, a complete discussion about the Oldest Colony as we lead into Saturday, the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Puerto Rico. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!